folks, and welcome to Christ in Every Word, a podcast of the Concordia Bible Institute, housed on the beautiful campus of Concordia University, Wisconsin. This is your opportunity to read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest the sacred scriptures with Dr. John Seleska, Director Emeritus of the Concordia Bible Institute, and me, Dr. Brian Gurman, Assistant Professor of Theology here at the University and the current Director of the Concordia Bible Institute. Over his long career as a parish pastor, college, and seminary professor, Dr. Seleska is known for highlighting the centrality of Christ throughout the entire Bible. So it's an honor to be with him here in the podcast room to listen to what he has to say about all these historical books. We just finished the book of Judges last time, and that brings us to the book of Ruth.
Ruth it is.
Still in the days of the judges.
But yes, we really haven't left the period of the judges because this occurred during the period of the judges.
Right. So what kind of introductory material do we need to know for the book of Ruth?
It's we need to know the idea that this happened early in the period of the judges, simply because as you look at the genealogy at the end, the very last verses give a genealogy all the way up to David. But the birth of one of those ancestors of Christ is given there. It is very fascinating since a Gentile is included in that. And that would, of course, here be Ruth. And she's a Moabitess. And she is included when you know that the Jews were very exclusivistic. And yet, this one would be included, I think, because of the high regard in which she was held. You can see that in the book itself and by her future husband. We'll get to that, Boaz, when he really admires her loyalty, and not only to her mother-in-law, Naomi, but also to the Lord. And she makes mention of that when she refuses to stay with her own people in Moab and comes back with her mother-in-law to Bethlehem, where, of course, she was originally from when she left with her husband and her two sons. So that's an interesting part. And we'll, again, of course, mention that when we get to chapter 4. We'll mention how the whole thing plays out and that this plays a part in the coming of the Messiah, and of course Matthew in his genealogy in chapter 1 talks about this genealogy and how this all really will give birth to the Messiah himself. And I like to think of it as maybe a fulfillment of that promise to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, in your seed all families of the earth would be blessed. Well, here are the Moabites, strangers, yet they would be included in the lineage of the Messiah. So they're more directly involved in the birth of the promised Messiah, Savior from sin. Then I think it's also important initially to look at the an overall picture of this interesting incident right in the middle of the book of Judges, in the period of the Judges, that all things work together for good, that Romans 8:28 passage, because this evil worked for Naomi's good. It couldn't have seemed worse to her, I suppose, when she's in Moab. She's lost her husband. She's lost her two sons. Really, everything that she regarded highly was gone. And yet the Lord has in mind for her something which I think is almost staggering and would be in her estimation, because she's going to have a grandchild who will, she will be able to call her own child, and the women call her that at the end also when they congratulate her for what has happened with her daughter-in-law, the daughter-in-law who has been so loyal to her. That's sort of an overview. This we need to note that in the house of bread, Bethlehem, house of bread, there's a famine which causes the move. That's the first verse. So maybe we should turn there and look at that a little bit. It's interesting. House of bread, but no bread, or at least a scarcity of bread. And I think as we look at this family, Elimelech and his wife Naomi, and the two sons, Mahlon and Gideon, that there is something about the family that I think would cause them to move. Maybe they recognized that there was a weakness there, that they were sickly, because I think it's right away, almost in verse 3, that Elimelech dies. Now, the names are important, too. Maybe we should mention that, that these names seem to describe certain characteristics of the people. My God is king, Elimelech. My God is king. And so he has a high regard, I'm sure, for the God of the Israelites and recognizes his providential hand. And I'm sure he realized that as he moved from this house of bread down to Moab, where there was news that food was available there and that they could get there and could harvest the food for the family. Now, my reason for looking at those names is that it seems at least as if that maybe the husband also, Elimelech, because he seemed to have died early, Mahlon and Chilion. Now, Mahlon means something. Mala means something like invalid. Hmm. I don't know what your translation is, or does it give anything of his name at all? It doesn't. Well, invalid, and Kilian means like weakness. So there seems to have been, perhaps, they seem to have been sickly of some sort, because they die quickly also, very soon after the marriage. We haven't mentioned that, but as soon as they got there, it seems they're going to stay 10 years. Now, is that verse 3, something like that? They're going to be there about 10 years.
That's right, verse 4.
In this land, mm-hmm. Of the Moabites. And we need to maybe mention this about the Moabites, that they're distant relatives. That from our study of Genesis, maybe our listeners, those who are still
chapter
with
19.
Us, yeah, if there are any of those original listeners who are still with us, would remember that in chapter 19, yeah, there's a statement there, a last verse, I think, last two verses, really, that Lot has two sons by his two daughters. One of them is Moab, and the other Ben-Ammi, Ammon. So Moabites and the Ammonites derive from Lot, Abraham's nephew. So it takes us way back, and these are those people. And perhaps the people also will recall that when Israel went out of Egypt toward the Promised Land, that they were not permitted to go through the territory of the Moabites, so they sort of went around it to the east and then attacked up above that particular territory again, probably because they were related. So it might seem odd initially, but that since these people seem to have been related, I suppose Elimelech and his wife said, listen, we've got to go somewhere. We've got to do something. Our family is wasting away, and we need to take precaution that doesn't happen as suddenly as maybe it would have if we have to scrounge for food. And so that's another thing that we need to remember about the people there. But we need also to know that their god was Chemosh. And if you know any of the customs at all about the gods of some of these tribes, you know that they had infant sacrifices, that they would drums would roll, and the idol sometimes would be of bronze, heated up inside with a huge mouth, arms extended, and then the babies would be placed in those arms and rolled into the mouth of the god, where there were flames, and that child would, of course, roll into that God screaming, but it was supposedly, at least, would cause the God's favor to dwell on the people who engaged in that kind of, quotes, worship, religious service. So they would be exposed to this kind of idolatry, and yet I guess they recognized how important it was for them to survive, to go. So they did, and they're there. And Elimelech dies, and then Mahlon and Chilion die. So there she is, left alone, bereft of everything. Now what to do? I mean, she could have stayed. She had daughters-in-law. I mentioned that, but both Mahlon and Chilion married these daughters, these daughter-in-laws. I don't know if they were related or not. I don't think so. But they married Moabite wives. Ruth, of course, the important one. Orpah is the other. Orpah means something like stiff-necked. Sometimes that word is translated gazelle, or animals of that nature are used sometimes as translations for that word. Ruth, of course, means a companion. I should have mentioned that Naomi means sweetness. I'm going to leave it there because there's a contrast which will come later on. There are some other translations for that name also, but let's leave it there because it relates to something that is going to occur later on. So here we are. She's going to make her decision to go back to her people. She doesn't really have anyone there aside from her daughters-in-law. However, that's no small thing because those daughters-in-law really had become very attached to her, their mother-in-law. I guess, interestingly, considering how sometimes in our country we view mothers-in-law, too often there are disparaging remarks made about mother-in-laws, but not so in this instance. They're very close to their mother-in-law, and both of them, when she decides to go back, I think is it now verse about 6 where it says, she heard that the Lord had visited his people. Interesting way to say it. It's almost as if he came. The people recognized that it was the Lord's hand which gave them, now, I guess, the barley and the wheat, the grain, which they were able to harvest now. She's heard that that's all happening, that she can go back. She has property there. Her husband Elimelech had property. She's going to go back, and she intends to do so alone because she feels that the daughters-in-law, and it makes sense, the daughters-in-law should remain there and have husbands who could provide security, because she said, I really can't give you any comfort or security. I don't have anything. I don't, and you don't, you need husbands. I think in that culture, it was very important that you have a husband who would give you the security you needed as a woman. You would have the man's children, and you would, then you would provide for the family life as the mother of the children and the wife of the husband. All of that was essential under those circumstances. So none of that could be provided, and Naomi recognizes that. So when the daughters-in-law
is how the ESV puts it.
Everybody has problems with that, and I have problems with that. And I'm never sure if I'm right. I guess I said it right then.
I wondered the same thing, and I'm looking down at the Bible, and it says daughters-in-law. So I'm going to go with the ESV
ESV.
There we go.
Anyway, they wanted to go along. And as a matter of fact, seems as if verse 7 and 8 there, as they depart, that they do go with her for a period. And then she, of course, asks them to return, and she says a strange thing when they sort of react negatively. They want to go. Interestingly, they want to go to be with her people. And then she says, well, would I be able to marry and have sons, and would you be willing to wait for those sons to grow up to be your husbands and for you to have children by them? It seems rather strange to us for anyone to say that. It's obvious. And yet she says it. So I think to make this very bleak, the outlook so bleak, as a matter of fact, that neither of the two would be willing to deal with that kind of circumstance. But nevertheless, they both weep, they both cry and embrace Ruth because they really don't want to leave with her to leave without them. And then finally she persuades Orpah. Orpah does go back, and when Naomi tries to persuade Ruth, look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her mother. It says mother's house, too. I don't know if it says it in yours, but mother's house rather than father's house. That to me is quite interesting. Maybe that's the custom among the Moabites, too, that the mother provided enough strength in the family for her to be the one to whom daughters, at least, would return. And she's returned to her people, to her gods. Does it use gods?
It sure does. Your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. in verse 15.
Yeah, very interesting that the gods, and Chemosh, I mentioned to you, is the one chief god among those people, but they often had other minor gods. And so she's gone back to those. Now, I don't know what that says about Orpah. I don't know what occurred subsequently. We just are never given any information beyond what we have here in the text. But it is interesting. It says that Ruth clave to her.
It is interesting because at first they both say, no, we're going to go back with you, both of them. But then when Naomi says, well, about the sons, I don't have any more.
Right.
Are you going to get married? Apparently, Orpah thinks, oh, well, mom's got a good point. Maybe I'll find some other better way. But and then, as you're saying, Ruth cleaves to her.
Yeah. Now, that's interesting, too, because it's almost as if she understood what we understand from Romans 8. If God spared not his own son, but delivered him up for us all, shall we not also with him freely? Shall he not also with him freely give us all things? In other words, she didn't care about material possessions. She didn't care about all these earthly, quotes, blessings and advantages. She wanted what Naomi and her people and that God had to offer. And so when I said initially, well, all things work together for good, they really did for Naomi. It's all going to come out even, I think, better than she could possibly have imagined.
That's true.
And I assume that somehow or another she had communicated this idea. I'm trying to think of, there's a Job passage, I think, gosh, 10, Job 10, somewhere in there where it talks about when she got back, she said, don't call me Naomi any longer. Call me Mara, because the Lord has dealt bitterly with me. Don't call me sweetness. Call me bitter, because the Lord has dealt bitterly with me. You know, often to Mara's brink, that the passage, Exodus? You know, where they came to the
17, I think.
Bitter waters.
Mm-hmm. Mara, Meribah.
So call me Mara, because the Lord has dealt bitterly with me. She recognized that, and she said, you know, I don't know which verse it is here, about verse 20, 21, where she says something like, he's afflicted me, that the Lord has afflicted me,
mm-hmm.
and that he testified against me, the King James says it that way, and he afflicted me.
Same here, yeah.
Yeah.
He brought calamity upon me.
Yeah, well, she was willing to she understood that the Lord's hand was involved in these things that happened to her.
Right.
Contending with her, that's how Job put it, the Lord contends with us when he afflicts us.
Right.
And I thought, well, that's sort of Pauline, you know, where I have learned in whatever state I am therewith to be content. I know both how to be abased and how to abound. Everywhere, in and all things, I am instructed both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do anything. So it really didn't matter to him. I mean, whatever the circumstances were, he knew. And it's almost as if Ruth had learned that.
Yes.
Right. And was willing to go because she recognized this. She had been well instructed, evidently, in that family.
Yeah.
They must have been a very pious, God-fearing family to get that message across. And I suspect that even Orpah realized that and didn't want to lose it, but realized also there are these earthly consequences that she just really didn't want to experience, which is understandable.
Well, at that point, I'm looking at the time here. Maybe we'll take a quick break here, and then we'll pick it up again with this whole scene. And Ruth has a very profound confession in the midst of that. We'll start with that on the other side of the break.
We'll be back in just a moment to the Concordia Bible Institute podcast. In the meantime, I'd like to have you consider this question. What is most important in higher education? How do you prioritize all the knowledge to be gained at an institution of higher learning? Concordia University, Wisconsin, located on the shores of Lake Michigan in Mequon, Wisconsin, just north of Milwaukee, is an institution that is committed to excellence in learning, but at the same time realizes that excellence in itself is insufficient without development in vocation. We believe that God works through our vocations, our callings, in order to serve the needs of those around us. The mission statement of Concordia University puts it this way: Concordia University, Wisconsin is a Lutheran higher education community committed to helping students develop in mind, body, and spirit for service to Christ in the church and the world. You can learn more about the over 70 programs offered at Concordia by visiting the website, www.cuw.edu. And if you're benefiting from our Christ in Every Word podcasts, I encourage you to support this ministry by mentioning it to others and by offering your monetary support. Please consider supporting the Concordia Bible Institute by going to our website, www.concordiabible.org, and clicking on the contribute page. And now, back to the podcast.
Alrighty, we are back with our study of the book of Ruth here. We're making our way through the first chapter. We just talked a little bit about this departure of Orpah and Ruth. Orpah was probably instructed in the faith. He said, God-fearing family. She probably knew a thing or two about Yahweh and the wow. people of Israel and things like that. And Ruth seems to say, you know what, even if it costs me my yeah. husband or the possibility of marriage, economic security, any of these things, I want to be where the God of your God will be my God, and that's the way
yeah.
I want it to be no matter what.
And put that into context. The people were there, that is, Elimelech and his wife Naomi, were there because, quotes, their Lord had the produced this famine in the land.
Right.
The grain wasn't growing.
Which sounds like what would happen if in Deuteronomy and Leviticus, if you're yeah. disobedient, yeah. hey, I'm going to bring, your crops aren't going to, you know,
right.
produce.
I think Leviticus things are, chapter 26, something like that.
Yeah.
It says, the heavens are going to become iron and the earth
yeah,
brass.
Right, right. Yeah.
So, you know, you're not going to be able to grow
in the
anything.
Days of the judges, everybody was doing what was right in their own eyes.
Right.
So I think
they attributed all that to the Lord.
Yeah.
And Ruth and Naomi must have heard that. And still, what kind of God is that? I mean, secular person would ask that question. Who wants that kind of God?
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, it's often said by the secular world when tragedies happen, like 9/11 tomorrow.
Right.
Isn't that 11 tomorrow?
Yeah, that's correct.
9/11, where was God? Now, they, of course, are doing that not because they care about God at all, but somehow in derision. You talk about your God, where was he under those circumstances? But that's interesting. Not these two ladies. They seemed really to have been impressed and to have come to believe under whose wings later on we're going to find that statement made in chapter 2 by Boaz, under whose wings you have come to trust.
That's right.
And there is a passage that reminds me about, I think, Psalm 91, where it says, he shall cover you with his feathers, mm-hmm. and under his wings you shall come to trust. That's an expression. It says, you know, God doesn't have wings, I guess people would say, although I kind of would contend that the angels do, and they're the ones who kind of protect. I don't know if you could attribute that to God. But I think to some degree, that expression really does entail much more than we give it. I mean, under whose wings you have come to trust, if you can think of chickens under the wings of the mother hen. They're very safe there. She settles down on them, and they're very safe. And I remember a little story once about a farm. True story, as a matter of fact. There was a fire on a farmer's land, and it was burning toward the outhouse, those buildings, outbuildings. And the farmer started a reverse fire so that the flames in really would come together, and the mm-hmm. fire was extinguished. I had never heard of that, but then I did look it up, and it is a way of dealing with fire.
Wow.
And then he was walking through, and he noticed that there was a hen there. He didn't notice anything. He just noticed that there was a hen there, and she had been scorched and dead from the fire. So he just kicked it to be sure, and out from under that hen came chicks alive. They had sought refuge under her wings. And interestingly enough, not too far from it were some chicks who were burned and probably had not heeded the call of their mother, had wandered too far from refuge, and of course were destroyed. Under whose wings you have come to trust means a lot more maybe than you give it credit anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But it is an interesting figure, and that's the figure which Boaz uses later on when he attributes that she believed this, and he attributes that to her, that she's a woman of virtue, a great virtue. And she, of course, has evidenced that in the way in which she has taken care of her mother-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay. So
I was reading. I'm kind of hung up on this Orpah and Ruth thing because I read somewhere about the medieval exegesis of this book. I study history of interpretation, and I know that in the history of the church, some of the earlier history of how to understand this book in a Christian way, in light of Christ, was that Ruth was seen allegorically as Ruth as a figure of the church who's a Gentile kind of grafted in, as Paul would say. But Orpah is that part of the unbelieving synagogue that goes back to her old ways. And eventually Boaz is the type of Christ that marries Ruth, just like Christ marries the church and things like that. You know, so it's sort of that's an allegory, and there's there are different ways to talk about it. But I do think that this Orpah, she's gone back to her people and to her gods. She's kind of saying the material stuff is more important than being connected to the Lord of Israel, who and where his gifts are present and things like that. I don't know. I guess
I'm more charitable with her, thinking she really did want to go. She wept when she finally made the decision to go back to her people.
Right.
And, of course, her gods are there. She would probably be bereft of any, we would say, any message from the real Lord, okay, from anyone among her kin and her family. So I suppose you could conclude that she probably fell away, but, if you want to be charitable,
we don't hear.
The Lord is really strong, and her faith was really
even
strong.
In the midst of affliction
and even torture and death itself. But I don't carrying it a little far.
Well, this confession by Ruth, I'd like to hear your thoughts on when she says, "You know, where you will go, I will go; where you lodge, I will lodge. Yeah. Your people shall be my people.
Then,
your God, my God."
Then that one, yes. And, of course, where you die, I want to die.
And that's right.
And where you're buried, I want to be buried.
That's right.
And if anything parts us,
Till
death do us part. I mean, she just doesn't want anything but death to get between the two. But she really, it says she clave to her. I've just not a word I'm used to. But
well, the same word, I think, is used in Genesis, where leave father and mother and cling.
Leave to his wife. Same word, davak.
Davak,
in Hebrew,
that's right.
It's interesting. That really means one. That's a really strong word to use here, Entreat me not to leave thee, nor to return from following after thee. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people, my people. Boy, it's, in other words, really, that's something. Your God there, my God.
Right.
But you couldn't say it any more strongly than that. Where you're buried, I'm going to be buried, and death will be all that would ever separate us. May God punish me in some way, afflict me in some way, if anything but death gets between us. Whoa, that really is a sermon in itself. And it's usually used at weddings, of course. The context doesn't really lend to that. You don't really use that when you use that text, but who knows how many Christian young ladies want that text, because it does, it's kind of sentimental, when it's used out of context, but at the same time, it really is a nice text. I mean, this is the way it's going to be for the two of us.
Right.
Especially if there's one of them that's an unbeliever, it's a nice text.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
It's kind of engage unbeliever, probably the man in most cases, that he should think this way. We'd hope he would think this way also.
Right.
Anyway, that does take us to the end of chapter. Oh, well, then it says that this is the time of the barley harvest, that last verse in chapter 1. At the time of the barley harvest, and but she stayed with Naomi in her home, and Naomi took care of her. So there they are, these two ladies, and Ruth is really going to take an aggressive stance here and become sort of the provider in the family. That'll be chapter 2. So.
Now the whole town was stirred because of them too.
Yes.
They said, "Is this really Naomi?"
Yeah.
And she says, "Don't call me that anymore. Yeah. Call me Mara. You talked about that because it means bitter." And I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Don't call me Naomi anymore. You wonder if maybe she's a little bit older, more distressed looking, and perhaps from all of this experience.
Well, it could be, because 10 years has passed, you know, and she has gone through a lot. And we know that trouble does really affect a person physically.
Sure.
And they were just probably also remarking, she's alone. She went out with a husband, 2 sons, and she's come back. And I don't know, whatever provisions they might have had, but she's come back with nothing except, except with, in a sense, everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that Ruth has that point of view. She really doesn't care if she has anything because she has everything.
Yeah.
And that's the way a Christian ought to think. If God spared not his own son, shall he not also with him freely give us all things? In other words, Paul's argument from the greater to the lesser. If he would do the greater, die. Send his son to die. Is there something in your life, some little thing in this life, in this world, that he wouldn't take care of? So he'll take care of the lesser if he would do the other. Believe that. In other words, keep that uppermost and foremost in your vision. The rest will follow. In other words, the same as that Matthew passage, Matthew 6, where if he takes care of birds and he feeds them, and if he clothes lilies, please, he'll take care of you, O ye of little faith. So he's encouraging faith. He's preaching faith. Look, trust little children. He'll take care of you. Not to worry, which is, of course, the problem with all of us. We just are so worried about the temporal things. Not Ruth, but we are too much in, have too much invested in what the things of this world can offer us. And that's the sinful nature. And somehow or another, it didn't overwhelm Ruth.
Right.
Which is really just, to me, remarkable.
It
miraculous.
Is. It is a miraculous confession of faith.
Yeah.
Really. It really is. Those are that good reason, I think, to stop, not only because of the end of the chapter, but also on those on that note right there, that in Christ we have all things.
Everything
needful, he will provide. And with that, I think we'll call it quits for today. But Lord willing, we'll be back to study more of this little story, 4 chapters. And we'll take a
Well, the next ones get really interesting.
They do. Lots of fun things to discuss.
Lots of intrigue. Two ladies getting together. And when they get their heads together and they got a man involved, you know,
all kinds of
nothing,
things.
Nothing will escape their attention. They'll focus right on it and they'll get their man.
They'll take
like
care
of it. The Mounties always get their man. These two ladies are going to see to it that they have security.
That's right. Well, if that doesn't want to make you tune in next time,
yes,
I don't know.
You'll want to come back.
I don't know what will. So that's all the time that we have for this session of Christ in Every Word. But please consider mentioning this podcast to your family and friends so that they, too, can learn more about God's Word with us. The mission of the Concordia Bible Institute is to provide Christ-centered Bible instruction from distinguished experts who teach Christ in every word of the Old and New Testaments to strengthen faith and spread belief in the one true God. Again, if you benefit from this podcast series, I encourage you to consider supporting us by going to our website, www.concordiabible.org, and clicking on our contribute page. Until next time, I'm Dr. Brian Gurman with Dr. John Seleska, wishing you God's blessings in Christ Jesus our Lord.